Welcome to Castoverse. I am Christian Corley, and James McLean will be here a little bit later on, but not the James that you know, a James from 6 years ago. This special edition of Castoverse has finally been completed. This is the episode that we've mentioned a couple of times in the past. This features our lost interview with Philip Hinchcliffe. James chatted with Philip Hinchcliffe at the VorpCon convention in 2018, and it's fair to say that the intended discussion did not transpire in the way it had been planned. There were supposed to be various people there discussing the TARDIS and its purpose in Doctor Who and various other elements to the magic police box of the show. The problem was that when the day actually arrived and guests had been moved around and reattributed to different discussions and rooms and what have you, it was now just James and Philip Hinchcliffe rather than James, Philip Hinchcliffe and various others. Not ideal, clearly. The resulting discussion is a brave attempt to salvage something from the fact that you've got a room full of people. You've got Philip Hinchcliffe and you've got someone interviewing him. So that's enough from me, really, I think. I've set the scene for you. There were technical challenges. I've edited this as best as I can to improve the audio quality and to remove anything sort of irrelevant that doesn't really stand up to to any sort of scrutiny. There are some interesting elements to this discussion, which is why I decided, and with James' agreement, to bring this to you now. So, get ready, head to your own TARDIS, because we're going back to 2018, to the Print Works in Manchester, to the VorpCon event, and here is James McLean and Philip Hinchcliffe.
Okay, so I'll just give you a bit of an idea of why we're talking about this. I sort of talked to Gareth about this. I did a blog a while ago for a website called Critical Studies in Television, and something that really started to interest me was sets and floor plans and production. Sets. So like the TARDIS console room. I was actually looking at the Golden Girls, that famous science fiction, and how that set becomes so important to the audience. Their home becomes somewhere where the audience are really interested in. And over the years, that set changes. And since then, fans have actually tried to work out whether that house could exist. And they've mapped it out, and it's become an impossible house because they kept changing the set. But what was interesting was that for audiences, that set meant a lot more than it did for the people on the production. And I don't mean that in a rude way. It's just for production. You're on a time scale. You've got to get something out, a program out. You've got limited money. You're not so worried about whether Corridor A really links to Corridor B. But audiences are. And I think that's because it becomes a place which becomes our home as much as the character's home. So I thought with Doctor Who, we have this with the console. And well, Philip probably doesn't realise it, and something I'm hoping that I might try and explain a little later if we get the PowerPoint, his era was actually quintessential for a TARDIS console and for TARDIS in general. His people and his own input created changes and put narrative in there which would stay with the show till today, which is why I thought Philip, unsurprisingly, because I don't think he realises this, I think is really important to this topic. Plus, as I say, I don't think we talk about these places sets and TARDISes in terms of production, really. And I think that's kind of interesting, too. I mean, TARDISes, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there are fans who make TARDISes. Has anyone been to TARDISbuilders.com? No? Yes? Yes? A fantastic website where you'll see people actually recreating, like, the TARDIS sets of your era. And they'll be there looking for every piece of the items, of the what they're originally constructed from, and replicating that. And
you're not going to ask me that, are you?
No, God forbid, no.
I don't know the answers.
No, we're not going down that route. But I think it's interesting that audiences have that sort of love of something which, from a production point of view, is part of a programme, is part of moving a narrative.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I thought...
It's like the Rover's Return, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And for audiences, I mean, you can go and visit that set, can't you? You can go to Rover's Return.
Yeah.
And obviously, at Cardiff recently, you can go and see some of these recreated or half-recreated TARDIS sets in the flesh. So I just thought, to start off with, I would make this really easy on you.
Yeah.
I just thought I would ask... TARDISes, what are your memories of them? And very honestly, what do they mean to you, if they mean really much at all?
Oh, okay.
Do you want to try the mic, fingers crossed?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, great, okay. The first time I saw the TARDIS was around about the time of... Was it Kennedy's assassination, or was it the Cuban missile crisis?
1963, Kennedy's assassination.
And I saw William Hartnell, and I don't know which episode, but it might have been the very first episode, I can't remember. But I dismissed it as a sort of kids' show, because I just got my university place, and you know, it's terribly superior, and thought, what a load of old tosh. So I never really watched it at all. In those days, when you went to university, nobody watched television. So, I didn't see the program at all. And then I suppose now again, I must have seen now and again Troughton's story. Not because I was watching it, I'd probably, hopping
through the channels.
So it didn't really mean a lot to me at all. When I took the show over, obviously I became acquainted with the history of the show and realized I had to honor, you know, all the history and, you know, the basic sort of elements of what made up the show. But one of my first decisions really was to try and take the show in a different direction, away from into more fantastic, you know, sort of space areas and alien worlds, or maybe alien worlds in the past, you know, with aliens coming on. And so it didn't seem to me that there was so much need to actually utilize the TARDIS set. And I kind of felt probably that the scenes that took place in the TARDIS that I'd seen were rather static, and not a lot was going on. And I wanted to get into my stories a little bit more sort of narrative thrust or narrative impetus, if you know what I mean. And so for all those reasons, I thought, well, we don't need to really have a lot of scenes in the TARDIS, and it's okay when they take off and they arrive somewhere, it's useful. So in a way, I'm not the TARDIS man.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I took it out of the show for a long time. But I know that the fans are very attached to it, and obviously it is an iconic part of the show. But that was my approach.
Did you do you feel that your when you watched the show in the 60s and the way that you saw the TARDIS on the television, do you think that had a sort of mitigating factor into what you felt it would mean to the show, whether it was relevant from how you'd seen it, or do you think it's more the fact that you were looking at the there and then, how you wanted the show, and it was just something, like you say, that you didn't feel had much consequence to the story?
Well, I think my view of the show when I took it on, I mean, it was made in a television studio. Television studios are flat floors with cameras that in those days were the size of a Dalek and trundled out like Daleks, and so they had to have flat floors. So the difficulty was every set or wherever the story went, if you weren't careful, people would just think they knew that they were in a studio. You couldn't create
a world that,
you know, they could believe
it was somewhere else. We were not making it. We weren't making it on film. We lost it.
Yeah. So basically. What I wanted to do with the show in simple terms is to get a bit more of an adventure story, but you can't, it's very difficult to tell an adventure story in these sets, and it's, you know, relatively small television studio as it was in those days. I mean, now the program is made, although it has a running set, it is made much more like a movie, and they get out and about much more. So I didn't really want too many what I thought were static scenes, you know, chatting about things in the TARDIS. You could move the story on, you could impart information to the audience where the story was heading, you know, in another set, basically, and so that the audience had a sense of adventure, you know, you're moving on somewhere.
So you never felt, oh, this is a good one, I like this one. You never felt that there was a need to slow the story down. So I remember someone saying with Blake 7 that they quite liked having standing sets because they could then just situate characters in one space which was already built and already paid for, and let the dialogue take up the time because they didn't have the money to do all the other things. You never had that with Doctor Who?
Well, yeah, we did. I mean, we did
use the TARDIS for those sorts of scenes, absolutely. Yeah, we did. But I just wanted to cut down the use of it, really. I don't have a special affection for the TARDIS set. And of course, it's quite difficult because you had to match the outside and the inside. And often you were cutting the film, which, you know, looked different to the electronic entity of the television camera. And also you had the problem of how do you see through the opening door of the TARDIS. And that used to take a lot of time up in my days, because you had to sort of place something in and lay it over. So usually, you know, he walks out of the TARDIS and then you see him coming out, you know, you never see the joining with it. So it's quite a problematic set, although it had its uses.
Did you have any responses from fans at the time? Because we'd had in the 60s...
I can't remember.
I don't mean specifically, but you didn't ever get any feedback? Because, I mean, John Nathan Turner would often sort of say that.
I can't remember any feedback, not at TARDIS, no.
We had something.
Oh, right.
Can I use that?
I don't know. It's a terrible picture.
I'm sorry. It was the best I could find.
No, but it is. Because it's not a picture. It was lifted off a video, so it's like a freeze frame of me and sort of... A bit like mine, I think.
I mean, I just thought I'd highlight all your stories.
Oh, right.
And the ones in yellow are the ones which you had the TARDIS console sets.
Oh, that's interesting. So, right, yeah.
And we had two console sets in your time. We had this more traditional whitish one, which I think was Kenneth Sharp.
Sharp, yeah.
He created the Pertwee's era, yeah. And then I think it was refurbished. And then you and Barry Newbury.
Yeah, we did that one, this one. Yeah.
So can we move forward one more again? I feel like such a king. Very quickly, I'm just sort of the flow of it, for the people who might not be aware of this, and maybe for Philip as well, sort of how it changed. And it's interesting enough, as I'll point out later, how different the one in New Commission was compared to the others, and it didn't have that same sort of aesthetic change. It's just sort of visible in the other ones. Can we move on one more? Also, so these were the more later ones, and obviously we've got a new one coming out soon. Michael Pickwell obviously cast away last month, which is a great shame. We did this amazing sort of set. Would you have been frustrated with that sort of set? Because it would be a standing set. I mean, if you could imagine doing Doctor Who, for your sort of idea of what you thought Doctor Who was, would something like that just be something that would be in the way, or would you feel that you could use that, or you'd be interested in a sort of...
Well, yeah, that's... You needed it, yeah, because you're doing 20... Well, we were doing 26 episodes a year, but
it's just they haven't changed much. I mean, if you watch Doctor Who now, the TARDIS is still using the same way that you were using it.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
They talk a bit,
yeah.
They may roll around a bit,
that's
through
right, yeah.
Some battle or something hitting them, and then they exit.
Yeah.
And yet here we have this massive... Would that be? I'm not wanting to be critical about it. I just wondered whether, from a producer's point of view,
well, no, it's just a better set. It's more film, more filming. It's more interesting, and so you probably use it more because it's a bigger space. You could probably have action scenes in that, which if we had any action scenes in our TARDIS, I can't really remember, but it would just be a sort of fake grappling.
No, we
it just wasn't believable.
We will have a video of one of those rare action scenes in a minute. Interestingly, what was it? I can see a foot. It's like...
This is turning into like an Eric and Ernie strip. It's Jeremy Bassi when they came in, shooting with furniture. That's what this is, the comedy show. We tricked you into thinking it was about the TARDIS.
It's a pitch. This is a pilot. We're going to see if we can get BBC to pick it up. We'll call them.
We had to rebuild the police box because it used to live in the outer and seam ring around the dugout, and it just, you know, got bashed about, really. You know, forklift trucks used to bash into it because it's on the corner. When I walked in on studio days, I walked up to Wild City from my office, it's on Shepherdstush Green, and all the studio during, you know, the White City building. And I used to go in the back door, and I used to go through the outer seam ring, and I never looked, and every day I went along there, and it would flash about a bit more. So yeah, we had to make a new one. I can't remember what show we built it on. But
I think it was Muscular Main Program as well.
Yeah, when
you introduced this set as well, which... Yeah. The prop you had originally, I think, was the very original prop for the exterior.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They've been going for many years. And again, there's people who are so fascinated in this. There's Peyton Hickman on Twitter. I mean, he sort of shows exactly where these damages happen.
Oh, really? He's a TARDIS anorak.
A massive TARDIS anorak. But at the same time, it's interesting because it's history. And do you find it interesting that... Because history is often not made of moments of people thinking this is going to be historical. It's about things where you were just doing a job.
Yeah.
Now you're finding 40 years later, people have got you in front of a mishmash of interested parties talking about something which was like...
And I can't remember what I did.
Exactly. It's crazy how...
And also, a lot of what's written is just not quite true, it's not quite accurate. But it gets repeated and repeated and repeated. So in the end, that becomes the new reality, when actually it's not. And you go up time correctly saying that the winners.
Yeah, history is written by the winners or the person with the loudest voice.
Well, I met on Wikipedia. I don't know how they do that. There's some people who can manage the Wikipedia editorial board, they get all the wrong stuff on.
I mean, it's true. I mean, I saw when I was researching this that there was someone who was saying that first white room was totally rebuilt in your era, and then others who said it was a rollover from Barry Letts's day and refurbished. And it's like, well, again, you can see where.
But this is Alexa for me. I can't answer.
But yeah, but like I said, I mean, we've got everyone in here. I mean, who's interested in TARDISes here? Maybe not to that level, but who finds a TARDIS a fascinating thing? I mean, it has a cultural significance in a weird way.
Yeah.
It affects people so deeply on such a level. And I just wonder if that has changed over the years. I'm just curious, does anyone remember the wooden TARDIS, the sort of Jules Verne?
The one we did.
The one you did, does anyone remember that one? We'll have a picture of it in a second. I'm not going to ask that.
I remember Bob Purvis, I don't know why. I don't know where the idea it came from. It might have been Barry Newbury. Somebody said, well, you know, can't we do a new TARDIS that goes with a story? And Bob Holmes said, well, yes, there could always be a reserve TARDIS, a sort of control room. And so we just invented that. And then that made me think that really we could tell competing stories inside the TARDIS if we really wanted to, because I never really did explore. I don't know whether since my era they've done that, and I haven't found it. But because it's you don't know how large a TARDIS it is. I remember kicking ideas around and this is where the TARDIS became interesting for me. Was just we did kick ideas around for myself about people or aliens or whatever actually sort of being hidden. Gaining entry into the TARDIS is quite an important motif, I think, because we have the Mandagora here, that got in somehow, and I'm sure I think a lot of other stories after my era, which had done this. So I did toying with the ideas of doing that and having a whole adventure inside, but it would have meant bigger sets anyway, which would have been expensive, or maybe we could play part of it outside as if it was a section, a landscape or something within the carnage, you know. So we did actually toy with those ideas, but it never really came to anything. So but I think there are enormous story possibilities with the carnage, which probably haven't really been fully explored, you know. So, you know, it's about the alien Millie, you know, I mean, if something gets in and infects a TARDIS, and you don't know where it is, and the doctor can't remember where, you know, it's so vast, you know, probably there might well be parts of the TARDIS that no human being or doctor or Time Lord or anyone who have ever set foot in. Actually, if you think about the scientific logic behind it, it could be enormous. It could be, you know, it's like our universe and whatever, but I don't know how extensive the world could be for the TARDIS, but nobody's really gone down that road.
Yeah, I think there was in the 90s when it finished, was one of the books, I think it was, might have been Paul Cornell's book, which did that, and did a reveal at the end that they're actually still inside, and the whole story had gone through a book form until they made that term. I thought that was very clever, but yeah, I think you're right. Thinking the new series, I'm sure people can correct me if I'm wrong, is it about like really two episodes which have really looked inside the TARDIS, would you say? Yeah, I might be only Doctor Who.
What are you talking about?
In the new series, yeah. I mean, which has always surprised me because now we're in a...
How do you find that out?
I watch television sometimes and I see Doctor Who on... I mean, there's a story, Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS, which dealt with it, and there was another one which brings The Doctor's Wife, which sort of dealt with the TARDIS and what it is and what it means. But given that we're now in an age where Doctor Who's been made by people who watched Doctor Who and were fans as a kid, I am surprised that the TARDIS has not become a more explored thing in the way of you're saying. Which again I think is interesting. But anyway,
this is the Barry Newby one, isn't it?
The Barry Newby one.
Well, there's somewhere there should be the shaving mirror.
Yeah,
there's
the shaving mirror, I think, from Monica with the
episode. Yeah, and I've got that.
You have that?
Yeah,
you
know.
But it was
one of the souvenirs that I took.
That people were aware that it being a control room, that you assumed that was actually an apparatus of the TARDIS, and it's actually just a shaving mirror. I think.
Oh, right. Sorry about that.
It's almost like a postmodern thing. Can we move on to the next slide and see what the PowerPoint's destroyed? Everything, that's right. Our fans have even built, sort of suggested how. I know this is actually official BBC stuff, of what TARDIS could actually look like if you actually mapped it out. Can we move to the next slide? This is going to be tedious for me now because I'm not going to remember. Okay. So yeah, I'm trying to remember how I was going to do this because this PowerPoint's not going to help me anymore. I was going to have six, I think it was, things which I thought that you did in your era, or your production team and yourself, did the TARDIS, and what was important about it, and what people might not realise. This is one of them, and this is, as far as I'm aware, and if anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your era was the first one where we actually saw the TARDIS was more than a control room and maybe a couple of side rooms. Yours was the first where we actually had corridors and boot cupboards.
Yeah.
And as you said, Barry Newbury's...
the fact of the matter is that maybe this was not done by... Yeah, what we planned to do is, what happens is a story comes in, and a story has certain requirements. And so you get a story and it needs a little bit more space because this action has got to happen then, you know. And so you add these little accretions on. And so it's totally haphazard and according to the story.
Yeah.
So it starts to be like, oh, I know this. You know, let's do a new build with the TARDIS. You know, it's just sort of what we saw in demand, that's all.
But in the end, that becomes, it's a bit like a Deadly Assassin and Bob Holmes having the 13 regenerations, the Doctor being how long the Doctor can live for. that being part of a story, which then becomes part of the myth, which becomes part of the legacy, which is now we're on.
Well, I think that's one of the problems of doing very long runs on the series. They have different producers, different writers and directors coming along, and if you were bound by everything that the cat before, you couldn't, could invent anything on it. So you just have to sort of patch up the inconsistency, explain them away somehow, or ignore them.
But that's, and that becomes amazing when you get fans who become producers of the show, like Russell Davis and Stephen Moffat, who then take those errors or those small things and make them into something serious. And
They find the meaning in it.
Meaning in the mistakes, absolutely. Or the selective story, things one story. Next slide, please. So, I mean, so far I've had the fact that you had a wooden TARDIS, which was like no other TARDIS before, no TARDIS after it, which I've done on this slide. This was a very different TARDIS design that Barry did, that you commissioned and you were comfortable with, compared to the traditional thing. This had never been done before. And this idea of a secondary control room was never done before. And again, that becomes law. That becomes part of the myth,
okay.
Which I think is pretty special. Tom looking quite wonderful there.
The thing is, I did this one then.
Yeah.
Not much worked, I mean, it all looked phony. When I got to this sort of doing this and doing that and doing this, it all looked a little bit phony and not very believable. So that's one of the reasons I didn't like too much going on in the TARDIS. However, I think the new TARDISes sort of evolved, but they actually look a bit more plausible, the stuff that they have, the push and pull and all that.
There's so many barriers in a way, because you've got these sort of supports that stick around it.
Yeah.
You've got a table in the corner and a chair, I think there is.
Yeah, it's reasonably convincing. You've got Jules E. Byrne sort of looking at it.
Because interesting, Janet Fielding, Tegan, said last month actually on Twitter, when asked about her TARDIS, which was essentially this sort of type one, used to say, and she said her TARDIS does not compare to the glory of the modern one, all those bells and whistles, multiple layers, ours was a traditional barren wasteland with the console in the middle. So she sort of echoes what you're saying, is that in the end there's not really much to do, there's not much to plot, there's not much to...
I mean, the origin of the TARDIS set is that the show, the very first start of the show, was made in Lionsgate Studios. Lionsgate Studios
are
tiny, they're smaller almost than this room. And so, I don't know how many sets they had in each story in this era, but very few. I think then it did move up to Lion City. So that's why. They had this one large-ish set of them, and they just sat and stayed and chatted for ages. There wasn't much else they could do in that tiny studio. So that's the raison d'etre, I think, for it, really.
I think it's interesting, as you say, the difference within the production eras. In your era, you wouldn't... Sorry. That would become...
We managed to put all
one. Sorry about that.
Are you all right? My family do the same. It's quite...
We won't talk about it here.
Can we move to the next slide? I don't know whether this is going to work. Oh yes, we had, and again, this would have been on one of the videos, this very iconic scene between Louise James and Leela and Tom Baker about the TARDIS being two boxes, one very far away being the large box and the one very close to you being the small box, and if you could keep them at those distances and fit them together, you could have this idea of how the TARDIS is bigger on the inside than smaller. And this again became part of the legacy. And before this, it wasn't really talked about. So I think it's interesting that maybe it's a time of the show's life when you get about 12 years in, where maybe you do end up having to talk about these sort of things because they become things that children who have grown up start to ask about. I don't know. But this was in your era as well. Beautifully laid out on this barren wasteland of a slide. What's the next slide to disappoint me?
There's my shading mirror.
There it is, there's the shading mirror, right there. Um, I, And honestly, now because I've got the writing, it's hard to say what this one was going to be. But I do.
I think we've done the TARDIS, really.
Is there anything else?
Who's, he wants to know any more about the TARDIS.
Well, oh, there we go. We've got text. Yeah, the things that Bob Palmer's put in, obviously time for decapsule, Arpon energy is a residual of time travel. These all became law within your production period.
Okay,
so can we just go on to the next slide? Because I think we're pretty much at the end of the slides. Yeah, that's the end of the slides. That's good.
I hope you enjoyed that, everyone. I certainly did. I've listened to it a few times, and I think it's a shame that it's taken so long to be able to bring it up to decent audio quality. The original version recording had a lot of audience noise in it, which was disappointing to say the least, and is the main reason why we didn't use it for so long. Please give this a share. As you probably know, there is a new book series being launched by Cutaway Comics called The DNA of Doctor Who. This first edition is the Philip Hinchcliffe years, which ties in nicely with our interview earlier on. So if you head over to cutawaycomics.co.uk and check it out, it's available to pre-order with shipping in September 2024. There are two editions, a paperback edition and a hardback edition. The paperback is $29.99, the hardback is $49.99. These are A4 sized books of 204 pages in length. That's it for Casterbris this week. We'll be back soon. Until then, goodbye.